Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to the cutting-edge debates that happen here at Oxford every day. We know it's been a while since we last published a podcast, and we hope you're all doing okay. The good news is that we have a third season coming soon, which we've called The History of Pandemics. We'll be looking at 10 major outbreaks, from the Plague of Athens to the West African Ebola outbreak, and asking how these outbreaks have shaped society, what we may be able to learn from them today, and where we might be heading. To warm up for this series, we've recorded a bonus episode around our current pandemic, featuring two fascinating guests. First up is a conversation I had with Professor Peter Drobat, director of the Skoll Centre for Social Entrepreneurship, about the implications that COVID may have for our social, economic, and environmental structures. After that, we'll play some extracts from a discussion between Peter and Dr. Aoife Haney, research lecturer in innovation and enterprise, focusing closely on some of those economic and environmental impacts. Peter, many thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Peter. Great to be here.
I wanted to start with a rather broad question, if that's okay. So Barack Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, famously said, "You never want a serious crisis to go to waste." What would not letting this crisis go to waste look like in terms of the way we structure society?
Thanks. I mean, I think if you look at history, big societal changes often come in the wake of crises, whether that is our responses to the 1918 Spanish flu outbreak, which led to the development of some national health services, our response to World War II, which led to things like the Marshall Plan and the Green Recovery, the Great Depression, which created the welfare state. Big changes often happen in the wake of crises, and those can be good or bad. So we know that the world has changed dramatically in the course of 2020, and we know that we can't go back to normal, but what is that future going to look like? I think what's really important to reflect on as we now are many months into this pandemic is that what we're facing now was triggered by the outbreak of a novel virus, but that's really triggered a number of other crises, right? We're now living in the midst of course, a public health crisis, but that's triggered an economic crisis, an unemployment crisis, various societal crises and a reckoning with racial injustice, and then real questions around governance and democracy and the kind of leadership we need in an interconnected world. All of these were problems that existed before the pandemic, but the virus really brought them out into stark relief in ways that I think invisible problems became more visible to many of us. And what that does is perhaps create an opportunity to develop some consensus around these problems, or maybe around the kind of world that we want to live in. I've often said that the coronavirus pandemic is a dress rehearsal for 21st century problems, because this is a large global threat that threatens all of us as a collective that transcends national borders and boundaries. So we need to think about collective action to come through this and to get it right. And if we do get it right, we will be much better positioned to respond to other global crises.
But suppose the response were to be, we can look at this pandemic and we can see specific things that went wrong. So right at the beginning, it wasn't clamped down on in the way that it might have been, although some countries, including ours, have made all sorts of advanced modeling of pandemics and so on. We actually haven't taken them seriously. We haven't put in place what we should have done. We didn't have the PPE ready and so on. But once we got a vaccine, everything's going to be fine. If we'd got organized so that when the pandemic came, we had all these systems ready to go, that would have been just great. And we can now learn that this is a way to deal with future pandemics. We can write off that threat. We can go back to normal.
I think it's been so interesting if you look at the way that we responded collectively and in different parts of the world to this threat as it emerged in early 2020. And what's interesting is that some of the most advanced and well-developed and best resourced countries in the world had really the worst responses to the crisis as it unfolds. And I'm thinking in particular about the United States, certainly to an extent the UK, where a sense of kind of complacency and exceptionalism and we've got all all the smartest scientists and all the resources will be able to deal with this, and it shouldn't be a problem that the advice of institutions like WHO is for poor countries. And so ironically, we have seen countries like Rwanda and Thailand that have nearly eliminated transmission of the coronavirus from their borders, countries with far fewer resources, whereas we've seen an extraordinary amount of preventable death in some of the wealthiest countries in the world. In that sense, I think it's turned the world upside down a little bit, and hopefully allowed us to question these gradients of expertise. Part of that comes from, I think, maybe a false sense of complacency or security. And in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, where there have been other outbreaks and epidemics, you're going to be on high alert for these things.
Might one not respond, well, of course, yeah, that's a one-off. It's because we haven't had a pandemic that's affected us here for a long time. Obviously, in countries where they had more recent pandemics, SARS and so forth, they responded more appropriately and more quickly. Next time this comes around, we'll know. We'll be prepared, at least for the next 10 or 20 years until we forget again.
I sure hope so. And this shouldn't have been a surprise in the sense that we all knew it was going to come. Those of us in public health have been saying for years, it's a question of when, not if. Of course, we didn't know if it would be a coronavirus or another kind of pathogen. We didn't know that it would be this one at this time, but we knew it was coming. It's almost inevitable in a world of globalization, urbanization, and climate change that we've seen an increase in the number of emerging infectious diseases just over the last couple of decades. All that said, we have in many advanced countries been disinvesting or underinvesting in public health systems for many, many years, and health systems more broadly. And now we're really paying the price for that. So I do hope, obviously, that as we come through this crisis over the next couple of years, that we understand that investments in strong public health and equitable healthcare systems are really smart investments. We are going to be living with this virus for probably several years to come. And that means all of the alterations in our daily lives and the way that we move and we work and we learn and we operate as a society, we're going to continue to need to figure out how to do this. This is going to be a marathon, not a sprint. There really is going to be no going back to normal. And we need to think about a long game here.
And presumably some of the reason we might not go back to normal will be because changes that have to happen in the interim actually turn out to be desirable in certain ways. I mean, take, for example, the shift from working in offices in the center of cities to home working. That's been forced on us for a short time, but there are apparently quite a lot of workers who would rather, thank you, not go back to the 9 to 5, 5 days a week.
As a doctor and entrepreneur, I've never really worked a 9 to 5 schedule, but I'm with you on that one.
Has that changed the leverage between employers and employees in a way that could bring permanent changes, do you think?
I do think there are aspects of this that will be permanent. And, you know, I think for most people, there's been obviously a lot of challenge and a lot of, suffering as a result of lockdown and some of the other fairly extreme measures that we've had to impose. But there have been little silver linings here and there. And to some extent, that's been learning that we can work differently. Now, I think a lot of people who are working in sort of white collar settings or in schools are pretty tired of Zoom calls and would like to have a little bit less of that. But I think we have learned that the way that we worked doesn't have to be the only way, and we can have a lot more productivity if we allow folks the freedom to work from home and to work on different schedules. That can have some knock-on benefits as well. If we don't have massive car commutes into cities anymore, that's going to reduce pollution and reduce emissions, and that has a number of benefits, obviously. Then there are going to be some unintended consequences, the sandwich shop vendors and things like that. So I think some of this will stick. It's probably too early to say how much this is going to reshape the workplace. But in so much as it does, it will also, I think, reshape how our cities are organized and have really long-term implications. I think it's a good example of how, as we think about the future, there are some things we desperately miss about our lives. That's maybe the ability to travel and see to see loved ones, to do certain things that we love to do. And there are other aspects of our lives or our society that maybe we're kind of happy to leave behind, things that weren't working so well before. And so our real challenge ahead is to think about how we can reshape things, how can we reshape our systems, our societal and economic systems in ways that can create the future that we want.
So some of the changes that come to society because of COVID may be forced on us, right? But on the other hand, some of this could be a matter of perception. COVID has made vivid things that actually were there all along, that there were possibilities of doing things differently. And that maybe now we've become more aware of that and we want to take advantage of that. Now, you talk about reshaping society. In the first case, it's fairly straightforward. If there's a public health need, then politicians and people and everyone are going to agree, yes, we need to make these investments or whatever. But in the other case, there may be tensions, right? Those who are the top dogs, given the way society is organized now, are not going to want to change things in the ways that might seem desirable to others. So how do you see the dynamics of that working out?
Status quos remain because there are powerful forces that reinforce them. And that often has to do with power differentials. And oftentimes, even in broken systems or systems that exclude or marginalize or hurt a lot of people, they can benefit other people. And oftentimes, those are the people with the power to shape those systems or to hold them in place. And that's why large-scale change in any sector is so challenging, and why it often takes a disruption to create the sort of tipping point for that change. Something that at the Skoll Center we think a lot about is how social entrepreneurs can try to get at the root causes of those problems. The probably strongest leverage point for driving large-scale systemic or societal change actually has to do with changing hearts and minds, shifting social norms and mindsets. And that's incredibly difficult to do. We're seeing elements of that happening right now. You know, one of the first signs of this for me was going way back to, I think, early March, when a lot of lockdowns were just beginning. And there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, floating the idea of whether we need to think about universal basic income. And then you realize how much sort of the games have changed, how much ideologies have been scrambled. The reckoning that we're having both in the United States and Britain and also around the world around systemic racism and the movement for racial justice is another great example. This is obviously a deeply entrenched problem which has existed for generations, but has been visible to those who were suffering as a result of these inequalities. But a lot of others could live in the bubbles of their privilege and not necessarily feel that or see that or care about it in ways that maybe we should have. What's happened with the murder of George Floyd and everything that's come since with some of the largest scale protests and social movements we've ever seen has been a real generalization or normalization of this idea that, yes, we have a deeply embedded problem around racism invisibly in society, and we got to do something about it. So that kind of consensus is what's going to allow for large-scale shifts in many cases. And so that's one of the things that really gives me hope, that the pandemic has exposed these crises, right? Systems are invisible until they don't work.
Many people perhaps became aware that there were a lot of jobs which previously perhaps had been thought of as very menial and unimportant. And suddenly we realize that the people who are filling the shelves on the supermarkets, driving the lorries, and making the deliveries and all that, suddenly this was crucial. And the people who were engaged in high paid advertising jobs and finance were actually rather less important in terms of societal value than these far lower paid people. Do you think the lesson there is going to be one that endures?
I hope so. It's a good example of all of us having to reckon with what we really value as a society. And if we think about economics and what the purpose of economics is, we often hear that it's around sort of exchange of value. And if value is defined in a very narrow financial sense, then you see lots of, jobs like folks in private equity and traders and consultants that actually don't contribute anything to society in any direct sense, who do awful well and make a lot of money. And then a lot of the folks who are actually working on the front lines providing social or medical services, who are you know, keeping the economy going, keeping food on the shelves, have been undervalued. And by the way, have been put on the front lines and put tremendously at risk, right? Many of us had the privilege of being able to stay home for many months, whereas, you know, those who were, you know, working in our retail food systems, those who are working in care homes, and of course in healthcare facilities, were out there every day exposing themselves to the virus and in many cases tragically lost their lives. So I think we need to reframe our thinking about what the purpose of economics is and our conceptions of value. It's about how we use the resources that we have to thrive and to create the kind of world that we want. And so much of this is about trade-offs and about deciding what we value as a society. And I think if we start using that lens as we think about rebuilding, it's a good start.
I wonder if one thing that it could change is this. There is a tendency amongst those who are very keen on the market to take for granted the structure that underlies our lives, healthcare, education, scientific development, technology, and so forth. And they may add value just at the margin. In a way that makes their product, you know, their computer or their mobile phone or whatever is a little bit better than the competitor, and they clean up and make huge profits. But actually, that's only possible because society has provided them with the infrastructure that enables that to work. And they conveniently forget all the scientific and technologically publicly funded investment, which has produced both the technology that they benefit from in that way, and the distribution networks, and the society within which all of that can flourish. And yet they will say, well, you know, the profit's ours, we don't want to, much of this to be taken in taxation, taxation is theft, and so on. Actually, one thing that COVID does is by making clear how interconnected all these things are, you know, I'm sorry, you can't get those economic benefits without having, for example, decent healthcare, without having decent communications, without having things on the shelves in supermarkets. I do wonder if it can provide a fundamental corrective to that sort of very individualist view about the market.
One of the interesting things, I think, over the last couple of months is I think that some governments have been reminded that they actually have the power and responsibility to do the thing that governments exist to do, which is to protect its citizens. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, you know, I think we've seen so much disinvestment in the public sector, and particularly the public sector ability to provide services and healthcare and education. And now we're really paying the price for that, right? The fragility of our healthcare system in the UK was really exposed by the pandemic, and it's one of several examples. You know, the invisible hand of the market is not something that came down on a stone tablet that, you know, was endowed by the creator. It was, you know, it's a system that was created by humans and needs to be understood and regulated by humans, and we have the power to shape that. And the private sector has a role to play. Government has a role to play, and we need these pieces to work better together.
Peter, I'd like to move on to environmental issues shortly, but just first of all, you mentioned earlier that some new ideas that have come out of the pandemic include that of a universal basic income. What do you think are the prospects for that? Do you think it's something that ought to be trialed?
Yeah, I think that I don't know if I have a position on whether that's the right thing or not, whether we should do it for everybody, whether it should be truly universal or not. Having worked for many, many years in what's sometimes called international development, we've seen a really important body of research that demonstrates that what in that world we call cash transfers, sometimes conditional cash transfers, to folks who are living in extreme poverty, has enormous benefits that are economic, that are health, that are social, that are educational, that simply giving resources to folks, particularly those who are living on the margins, to create opportunity for themselves is tremendously powerful. And there's a real strong empiric body of research. the research, to my knowledge, in more advanced economies is thinner, but not entirely lacking in some Scandinavian countries, in Native American communities in the United States. There have been aspects of this. So I think that particularly as we, you know, we're now in the midst of a recession that may become a depression. We don't know yet. I think I hate to be a doomsayer, but I think we haven't fully reckoned with the true economic hit that may come as a result of the pandemic. I think a lot of the short-term rescue measures have helped, but as those things start to wane, and you know, confidence doesn't come back, consumer behavior doesn't change, the virus we continue to sort of deal with trying to stamp out outbreaks, the long-term economic pain is going to be really significant. I think we're going to see increases in poverty and food insecurity to degrees which some of us haven't contemplated yet. And in that setting, it's a really important consideration to simply think about cash transfers or universal basic income. And this would, I think, be a very optimal time to at least begin experimenting with ideas like that and trying to collect some data about whether that's a smart way to go.
I'm pushing back against that. Some might say actually a time when the government is already building up huge debts is not the best time to experiment with giving out yet more money to people.
I think, if you look at the history of financial crises over the 20th century and certainly what happened in the 2008 financial crisis, you know, I would argue that there's a strong body of evidence that there's going to need to be a Keynesian type response in terms of government-led fiscal stimulus to prop up and help to rebuild the economies and to replace the private sector. And frankly, if anything, doing those investments, making those investments, you know, now while interest rates and inflation are relatively low is probably actually a smart thing to do. Now, mind you, I'm not an economist. The other reason I think it's important is that people are suffering and government has a responsibility to care for and to protect its citizens. We've made a lot of boneheaded decisions under investing in our social sectors. Had we made more government investments in public health systems, we would have averted orders of magnitude more economic losses. And so I think that, you know, the reality is deficit spending by government is going to have to be part of this recovery. The question is, how do we do it? And are we smart about it, right? Can we create a Marshall Plan to rebuild our economies in a way that are going to be fairer and more inclusive? Can we create a green Marshall Plan that can allow us to address, the climate crisis, which hasn't gone away throughout this pandemic?
Indeed, I was wondering, I mean, not only, as you say, COVID has revealed that some of the ways we've done things in the past have been boneheaded. We've actually ended up having to spend far, far more because we didn't put certain provisions in place that would have been much cheaper.
That's right.
But yeah, a recent report that you know about, led by Oxford's own Professor Cameron Hepburn, who's director of the Smith School of Enterprise and Environment, and with a team of other internationally recognized experts, including Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and well-known climate economist Lord Nicholas Stern, has outlined 10 fiscal recovery policies, which they say promise to bring both short-term high economic impact after COVID and long-term structural change to ensure that the UK can meet its 2050 climate goals. So there you do have what looks like a confluence of ideas that can help in all sorts of ways, economic and climate and health and so forth. Do you think this is going to have an impact with the UK's current decision makers?
I think there are signs that it is influencing the thinking of governments here in the UK and hopefully elsewhere. What to me is so compelling about this research is that it makes a strong empirical argument for investments in decarbonization and green infrastructure that goes beyond the environmental benefit and makes an economic case that this can actually create more value for money. This can create greater returns on the government's investment, and that also it can actually create more jobs. It's making a strong economic argument for investments in environmentally friendly friendly policies. And that's something that I think we've not seen enough of. Part of that is of course because the economics of a lot of these technologies have changed, and so the cost of renewable energy, for example, is so much lower than it was even just a few years ago. The reality is that if you look at where we are with the climate crisis, think about what's happened over the course of this year, right? So there are estimates that in 2020 that our global emissions of greenhouse gases is going to drop by about 8%. That's the first time there's been a drop of any kind in probably my lifetime. That's obviously a good thing. Many of us have seen some of the happy little elements of that, right? And that is, you know, cleaner skies and cleaner air in our cities, the return of nature, and maybe hearing birds chirping in places in ways that you weren't before. It's a reminder of the future that we need, that we didn't know we wanted, and what's possible. That's great. At the same time, we have continued to see climate-related weather events and shocks. If we want to reach the targets that scientists say are needed to avert essentially a climate disaster, we would need to maintain that 8% drop in emissions that we've had because of lockdown for years to come. And obviously that's not possible, right? The answer can't be that we all stay home and we create an economy that's about anti-production. That's not possible. But the question is, we've already seen this as many societies emerge from lockdown. You start to see cities getting choked up with cars again, et cetera, et cetera. We can't go back to the way things were before. And so this is why it's so important that all of the big fiscal stimulus has in mind that we need to accelerate our move towards a decarbonized economy. It'll actually be cheaper over the long term. It'll create a much more pleasant world to live in. And to come back to Cameron and colleagues' argument from their research, it's actually a smart investment decision as well. And I hope that's persuasive.
But there are going to be winners and losers, aren't there? I mean, as you say, it will potentially create lots of jobs, but those jobs are going to be in, for example, you know, insulation, appropriate home building and so forth. They're not going to be in the sandwich shops in the city centres, and they're not going to be in commuter trains. So government's going to have to play a pretty crucial role, I guess, in facilitating those sorts of changes.
I guess what I would argue is, wouldn't you, if you're the UK government, rather those jobs be created in the UK rather than in China or somewhere else, right? So the other element of this is trying to be on the leading edge of this transformation, the sustainability revolution, which is underway already. The question is how it happens, where it happens, how quickly it happens, but the sort of tipping points are already happening. I don't know if it'll happen quickly enough, but the sort of the economics of things have changed. And so, ideally we want to be on the leading edge of that. Absolutely, it's going to shift. It's going to shift the kinds of jobs that are out there. I think at a time of at least threatened mass unemployment, the prospect of millions of new jobs should be a really good thing.
We've seen the climate crisis coming for a long time. Governments have come out with a lot of words, a lot of targets, but in terms of action, it's all been far too slow. Now, it could be that the arrival of COVID provides a sort of jolt, which says, oh, we have to rethink things. And amongst the things we have to rethink is the climate, which we know is the major problem. So now we're going to have that rethink. But alternatively, it might be that actually the coming of COVID brings new factors into the equation. Oh, we always had the climate issue, but actually there are these other things. For example, inequality is terribly bad for the world's health because it enables pandemics to spread ever so quickly. Lack of universal healthcare is a terribly bad thing, and so forth.
Some of the changes that we need to make have to focus around thinking about long-term value for society. We need to be able, frankly, to walk and chew gum at the same time because all of these things are connected. So if we can find a win-win like green recovery investments by government, that's the way that we need to go.
Thank you very much. This has been a fascinating discussion. Just to sum up, could I ask you, if there was one big change that we could make, what would it be? What's your biggest worry for the future? And overall, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, let me start with my biggest worry for the future, and then I'll come to my biggest hope, so we can hopefully move in a positive direction as this, as this conversation ends. You know, my biggest worry for the future is that we're going to get this wrong. We've talked about how we're facing a number of crises, systemic crises, at the same time that are all interconnected. So my biggest fear, actually, is that we get this wrong, and that we continue to see not only needless suffering from the pandemic and its ripple effects, but that we don't learn the lessons to kind of build back better, and we end up sicker and more unequal and more divided. I think there's a range of future scenarios that range from pretty bad to something that's really hopeful. What gives me hope is that I think we can do it. So the one thing I'd like to see is for us to pull together and realize that we are facing common threats. And the only way to overcome those threats is to work together and to collaborate together and to overcome some of those divisions, to understand and cooperate in ways that have been really, really hard to do. I think that our actions in the next couple of years and certainly in the next decade are going to define civilization for generations to come. I can't say whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic. I think we're on the knife's edge here. I think that what we do every single day is going to have a huge impact on our children, our grandchildren, and our grandchildren's children. And that's a huge responsibility for us to have. I'm hopeful we can step up to the plate, but a positive outcome is not guaranteed. You know, this is serious business and we've all got to get to work.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I've enjoyed that. That's been an extremely interesting and stimulating discussion. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Peter.
I mentioned earlier that we'd be including some extracts of a fascinating conversation that Peter had with Dr. Aoife Haney, research lecturer in innovation and enterprise. This conversation took place back in June.
As you said, I mean, this dress rehearsal kind of nature of the crisis that we're currently experiencing, and the ripple effects that you know, the crisis, it started as a public health crisis, but it has morphed into so much more than that and affected so many different systems. So, I mean, we've been thinking a lot about this because we started the year off teaching the MBAs in January, and it seemed like in January that climate was going to be completely dominating the headlines. You know, we were really emphasizing this point to the MBAs that this is the beginning of a decade of climate action. We were gearing up for COP26, the UN climate summit in Glasgow. And of course, that's now been postponed as a result of the pandemic. I think the current kind of crisis resulting from COVID-19 has certainly kind of has this element of kind of dress rehearsal, but it also is this critical moment for us to find ways to actually come out of the crisis and to recover in ways that allow us to address these other systemic problems that you mentioned. So I think there's been a lot of attention in the news and the media to date about the short-term effects of the pandemic on carbon emissions, on the climate. So the International Energy Agency predicts an 8% drop in carbon emissions this year. But the really kind of big thing to focus on here is we would actually need to see that kind of size of reduction year on year if we're going to be keeping to the targets that have been set in the Paris Agreement. So to try to kind of keep global temperature increases to less than 2 degrees. And the other kind of really critical thing here is that has come at the expense of shutting off economic activity, right? So we've shut down kind of big parts of economies in order to be able to have those types of carbon reductions. And that's created immense hardship around the world. And so for me, when I'm thinking about this connection between kind of the pandemic and climate, I think it's really important that we are clear that in order to address the climate crisis, we don't need to shut off economic activity. And we need to kind of make sure that that's a very clear part of the narrative going forward about recovery from COVID, because I think this gives us this incredible opportunity to say, okay, we have had things shut down. We've experienced, you know, what it's like to kind of breathe clean air in our cities, and that kind of stays with us to a certain extent, hopefully. But more than that, it gives us this moment to actually fundamentally change many things about what we do going forward, and in a way that can address not just the climate crisis, but also other systemic problems. right now, the reason that I think it's this very important moment, and lots of people are calling for this to be used as a moment of opportunity, lots of governments are starting to mobilize huge amount of spending for long-term recovery, and critically to focus obviously on recovering from the pandemic. But the research that we've been doing at the Smith School, so my colleagues, Cameron Hepburn and Brian O'Callaghan, they've led a new piece of work based on surveys of over 200 leading economists and economic officials. And they suggest that spending the money that governments are going to be spending anyway, spending it on climate-friendly green policies is good for the climate and it's good for the economy. And the examples of the types of policies that will actually kind of deliver those benefits. So if we put money into investing in green construction projects, for example, so building retrofits to make sure that we have insulation in homes and new heating technologies, if we invest in clean energy infrastructure, they have long-term benefits, obviously, for the climate, and we've been talking about them for many years, but they also have short-term benefits. They give people jobs. They're labor-intensive investment areas. They create and generate jobs at a time when unemployment rates are very high. And so we have this kind of combination of the short-term and long-term benefits from really focusing on these types of policies in order to kind of to reboot economies. And then the other kind of main message coming out of this work is that these policies can also be designed in ways that can address other underlying problems such as poverty and inequality. So for example, if we think about investment priorities for countries in the global south, it makes a lot of sense to be investing in supporting rural electrification and development, because this kind of gives a pathway out of poverty for many different people. It doesn't just provide access to electricity, it can also provide a way for farmers through having better access to irrigation technologies, electrified irrigation, to increase their crop yields. And so that gives a pathway kind of out of poverty. It also creates jobs, of course, in the electrification industry itself. And we're seeing through a lot of the conversations that we're having in sub-Saharan Africa related to off-grid energy, for example, is that businesses are really kind of ready for taking advantage of this opportunity and for thinking more broadly about what they can do next in order to, yes, address climate, but also provide jobs, provide rural development opportunities for people, and provide electrified healthcare opportunities as well. So that's one of the things that the pandemic has really made very visible in the global south, is that if we don't have electrified healthcare, then it's very difficult to provide ventilators for people who are suffering from COVID-19, for example. So it comes back to this visibility that you mentioned as well, that I think you've seen this exposure of fragility in the systems and a visibility brought to things that have been very invisible, or at least less visible to some of us than they might have been otherwise. In summary, I think it's this really big opportunity for policies during recovery to be good for the climate and for the economy, but also to address some of these underlying inequalities that we see that really pervade many different systems that we rely on. And I'd really love for you actually to pick up on this kind of theme of inequality, Peter, because I know you've been doing a lot of thinking about this. And obviously we've seen a big change with the recent focus and mobilization on the streets for Black Lives Matter. And there's lots of different effects of the pandemic on different communities. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on what we can learn about inequality from what we're experiencing at the moment.
Yeah, and I think this issue is so big and important. And another one of these things that has really been expose a kind of pervasive and insidious, and if you're living on the wrong side of inequality, of course, experiencing harm from it, it's something you live with every day, but then to many others in privilege, it's something that has been invisible. So of course, all the mobilization that we've seen in the streets and in communities across the world in response to the assassination and lynching of George Floyd and many others is largely geared around responding to this kind of epidemic of police brutality. But of course, it goes much deeper to what's really been a pandemic of systemic racism and inequality that actually cuts across all different aspects of our society. And so even before this all kind of rose to the top of everyone's minds over the last couple of weeks, given recent events, there was already emerging evidence that with COVID-19, something that early on people would call the great equalizer, because it's going to rich countries and poor countries and everyone can be infected. In fact, it's not, right? That we've seen a disproportionate burden on communities of color in particular, suffering higher rates of infection, higher rates of hospitalization, higher rates of death. Sometimes 2 to 4 times higher than their white counterparts in the same communities. The reasons for that are not biological, right? The virus doesn't discriminate, but we as a society really do. And so this is so important because it's not only affecting our response to the pandemic, but this is cross-cutting and it's deep and it's been present for decades or centuries. And it's something that we're going to need to reckon with if we're going to make progress on the pandemic, but it cuts across again all of these issues. So even if you think about climate action, the impacts of climates that we're seeing already are not felt equally by all countries and all communities around the world. The negative impacts are disproportionately affecting poor countries, for example, and particularly those who are already living on the margins. And we know the potential for those disparities is only going to increase. So whether it's about responding to this pandemic, whether it's thinking about our climate action agenda, we need to make sure that notions of equity and justice are front and center as part of our response.
And governments need to help us in stepping back and thinking about what kinds of services people actually need. What kinds of cities do we actually want to live in? And I think that's a critical role for policymakers to support the role of the private sector in engaging in climate action in the future. And it goes back to what we were talking about, this opportunity to actually use the moment that we have now to really develop policies that enable a recovery that is good for the economy and good for the climate and good for people as well, in addressing kind of inequalities that are deeply embedded in systems. So there's lots of work to do, but I think lots of inspiration as well from this dress rehearsal. I think we need to take as much as we can from learning about these rapid experimentations that we're seeing in collaboration and in collective action, and really bring that forward in how we think about rebuilding post-COVID.
My thanks again to Peter for his time today, to Aoife for letting us play some of those fascinating extracts from her conversation with Peter, and to you, listener. I do hope you've enjoyed this bonus episode. We'll be back with our new season soon and would hugely appreciate your reviews and ratings, which really help to get the word out about this show. Until then, I'm Peter Milliken and you've been listening to Future Makers.